Lions podcast. This is your host, Jason Poblet, coming to you again. Yes, again from sunny Florida. We are on the Florida Space Coast, home of Cape Canaveral, Cocoa Beach, the Kennedy Space Center. My friends up in Virginia, where GLA is headquartered, are dealing with snow, and I am not, which is fantastic. And today we're talking with someone who's also in a warmer part of the world, except she's on tomorrow, and we'll tell you why in a minute. And I'm on today, which is interesting. But it's a fascinating person. Her name is Dr. Kylie Moore Gilbert. She's a political scientist on Middle East issues. She was detained, held as a hostage for more than 2 years in Iran. We're connected with some interesting folks. We know some similar people, including several former hostages, former client of ours, and these are Zaka, Shiwei Wang, also mutual friends like Richard Radcliffe, whose wife was also held hostage. Recently, I got to finally meet Sam Goodwin, who she also knows, and even Jason Rezaian of the Washington Post, who was a former hostage also in Iran. And it's a fascinating story. I'm not going to share everything with you right here in the intro. I want to just jump in and talk to Dr. Kylie Moore Gilbert, who I have permission now to call her Kylie. Can I call you Kylie? Kylie?
Of course you can.
Okay, good. Well, I said that, folks, because my wife also has a PhD. And if I don't at least say doctor once, she'll come and tell me something. And by the way, for those of you listening, PhDs are a lot tougher than law degrees. I don't know how that was for you. How was it for you, Kylie? Was it a smooth process, or was it like my wife, Elam, who had post-it notes all over the walls for weeks and weeks on end as she prepared for her dissertation?
Oh, thanks for having me on, Jason. The PhD was pretty tough, and I had post-it notes. I had a crazy kind of filing system on my computer, and just, like a lot of printouts of stuff all over my office. But it was fun, and it was a really worthwhile process in critical thinking and applying myself, to a task that extended over a period of several years. I'm glad I did it, but it was a challenge.
That's awesome. Well, it probably was not as challenging as what happened to you in Iran, but before we talk about the hostage ordeal, tell us a little bit about yourself. Kylie's in Australia, folks, so we're recording this on a Tuesday. She's just starting her day, and we're grateful you can take some time off to do this with us. Tell us a little bit about yourself before you became doctor. What drove you to this profession?
I've always been an intellectually curious person, and I think I'm not one of those people who always knew what I wanted to be when I grew up, quote unquote, as a child. I enjoyed too many things and had too many interests and passions. I kind of fell into the academia thing, really. I did my undergraduate degree in the UK and spent a lot of time doing fieldwork research and learning languages in the Middle East. And the PhD and the academic career kind of grew out of that, not necessarily as a planned thing, but it just seemed like a kind of a logical next step for me, given my interest in researching the Middle East and learning the languages and learning more about the people and the culture and the religion. And I progressed on to a PhD and on to a lectureship at a university here in Melbourne, Australia.
Well, you live in Melbourne, Australia, and I live in Melbourne, Florida.
I wonder which ones you probably have better weather and I don't know, perhaps better food as well over there. I don't know.
Very different towns, Melbourne. I've never been to Australia. It's on my list. I want to visit. But Melbourne's a little more laid back. Melbourne, Florida is a lot more laid back, I think, than Melbourne, Australia. It's a much smaller town. I don't know if we have Australian food here, though.
Oh, what is Australian food? I mean,
I don't know. You tell me. Here it's Outback.
We have food from all over the world. No, Melbourne's on track to be the biggest city in Australia, actually, quite soon to overtake Sydney. So a big city in Australian terms is probably a large-sized small town or regional town in America. But it's much bigger here. Mm. We have a lot of migrant communities in Melbourne, and it's quite a vibrant place, really.
Is it a happening political place? Where is most of the politics happen? All over the place, I guess, or
Canberra, which is our capital in
right.
Australia, is the political capital. But it's one of those artificial capitals, a bit like, I guess, Ottawa in Canada or Brasilia, where someone's just, you know, on the map, put down a pin and said, that's where we're going to build this capital city. And it's kind of come up from scratch. And you can very much feel as though when you're driving through it, somebody's drawn a line on a map and said, there's going to be a street here, there's going to be a roundabout there. It has quite a strange vibe about it, but that's where the Parliament building is, and that's where all the politicians are.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of politics. I mean, you're a constitutional monarchy, right? So there's a little bit of UK stuff. Do you ever visit the UK, by the way, or have you any UK connection whatsoever, as far as personal family connections, or is all your family based out there in Australia?
No, I'm a UK citizen, actually. And I lived in the UK for about 7 years. I did my undergraduate degree there, and I, you know, worked there and based myself there in my early 20s. I do have extended family in the UK. But yeah, I mean, Australia is very different from the UK in terms of lifestyle, but we still have, you know, symbolically the king now as our head of state.
Wow. I spent a lot of time in the UK practicing when I was at another law firm and go back and forth a lot, but never was able to make the connection to Australia. So hopefully someday I will visit and I'll have a reason to go, have know somebody else out there.
So, oh, you'd be so welcome. And I think you'd really like it here.
Yeah, I think it'd be fun, especially the water. I'm a big water person, so it'd be a fun place to visit. Your journey to Iran, before we get to that, tell us briefly, because it's important, a little important connection to what happened and why they picked you up. Why did you pick to study your dissertation topic? Tell us briefly what it was and what drew you to it.
So I ultimately wrote my PhD on Shia, Arab Shia communities in the Persian Gulf, or the, you know, the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, particularly Bahrain, which has a Shia majority ruled over by a Sunni minority, which is quite interesting. But obviously there are also sizable Shia minorities in countries like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia as well. And I did my fieldwork there in Bahrain in 2015. This is all post-Arab Spring, so the sort of the dust of the Arab Spring was still settling in the region. Bahrain had huge, unprecedented Arab Spring protests in 2011. So it was a very interesting time to visit the region and to study some of these sectarian dynamics that had emerged, you know, following the uprisings of end of 2010 and throughout 2011 in the Arab world. So Iran was never the subject of my research. I'd never written anything about Iran. I'd never studied Iran, but it loomed there in the background, of course. You know, when we're talking about the Shia communities of anywhere in the Middle East, Iran figures there somewhere, you know. Today in Bahrain, there's very much the assertion that some of the groups there are linked to Iran, funded by Iran. Back then, it was less clear. And, you know, I'd still maintain that the uprising of 2011 in Bahrain was not inspired by Iran. It was a domestic part of this broader wave of Arab Spring uprisings that occurred in 2011. It was, you know, fueled by domestic grievances rather than by meddling Iran, you know, trying to interfere in Bahrain's internal affairs. But yeah, so that's ultimately what I wrote my PhD about. And I was looking at the democratization process in Bahrain, which, as in other Arab states, came to the fore in the early 2000s and was sort of put paid to by the Arab Spring.
So what drew you then to go to, explain to folks why then you went to Iran? And how is it connected to your work? I think folks will find that interesting. And then we'll talk a little bit about your book.
Yeah, I'd always wanted to visit Iran. I mean, Iran is an incredible, you know, civilizational power. It's the history of the place is just, you know, it's extensive. It's a fascinating part of the world to see. So just from a personal level, I'd always wanted to see Iran and visit as a tourist. And I had been invited by an Iranian university to attend a kind of a seminar or a conference there that they were holding for foreign researchers and academics. So it was in English. Most of the people there were from European universities, actually. Obviously, you know, Americans can't travel to Iran, so there weren't too many from North America. Yeah, I just saw it as a good opportunity to expose myself to a new part of the world that was relevant to my research, but that I had never visited before. And I didn't think would be particularly dangerous for me, given that I hadn't ever published anything that was about Iran or any sort of taboo subjects or red lines that that regime might have. You know, when you do field work in the Middle East or when you travel to the Middle East as a researcher, the entire region is almost entirely a sea of authoritarian dictatorships. So you just kind of accept it as par for the course that wherever you go, you're not entering a democracy with the rule of law intact as you would, you know, if you were traveling to Europe or North America. So for me, I exercised caution, but I didn't expect Iran to be any different to traveling to Bahrain or traveling to Egypt or Jordan or anywhere else.
For those who don't understand what academics do sometimes, why is it important to attend academic exchanges and conferences? I mean, most people would say, why would she go to a place like that? Women have to cover up and all that persecution that's out there. But why is it important? Because this comes up in some other hostage cases, and one in particular that I worked on that we'll talk about in a bit. But for folks who don't know the academic world, how would you summarize the importance of interacting with fellow academics?
It's our bread and butter as researchers is collaboration, research collaboration. You know, I guess there are two issues here. One is the importance of physically being present in some of these countries in order to study them, which I'm a firm believer in. I don't think, as I am a believer in that, you know, you need to learn the language of these places too, if you want to be an expert in that part of the world. You have to be able to go there and do field work and meet people and experience the country, learn the language, learn cultural communication strategies of the people and the government there and wherever it may be in the world. You're not a serious researcher, in my view, if you aren't able to visit the country of your research or, you know, speak the language or understand the culture. Even if what you're doing is quant stuff or whatever it may be, I just think that you do need to have that experience and it does inform the quality of your research findings. So there is that, and also, you know, us academics and scholars going to conferences, presenting our work, collaborating and forging new connections with other scholars and future collaborative efforts. It's really a big part of what the researcher does, and it's seen as, I guess, best practice. If we just sat in our offices in our universities and wrote papers based on our own ideas without, you know, consulting or meeting with or discussing those of others, it wouldn't be very very good research. So that's why we go to so many conferences.
And Kylie speaks, by the way, of course, English, but she also speaks Arabic and I'm pretty sure Hebrew and Persian now.
My Arabic is pretty terrible now. But yeah, like I studied Arabic at university and I speak Hebrew and now Persian, although the Persian's getting very rusty too, because
You don't
you know
use it as
I
much,
just
huh?
dis No, I mean I just learned it in prison really. And I don't really have too much opportunity anymore to speak Persian.
When you your pattern when you so let's talk start getting to that subject matter. And folks, there's a great book, you'll have to read it. It's called The Uncaged Sky, My 804 Days in an Iranian Prison. And I will provide a link in the program notes. Kylie was very generous and sent me a copy, which has now been heavily tortured by Jason because, as I told you, I write in my books, and there's a lot of questions in there that I'm going to ask you a few. It was a fascinating read and a very interesting book. The way they picked you up was very similar to what happened to other folks. You was on the way back to the airport after what you thought was going to be a pretty incident-free time in Iran. I mean, how was it, by the way, the time you spent at the conference, everything up to that point in 2018? How was it right before they picked you up?
you know, the conference itself went well. I had a great time. But about 24 hours before I was arrested at the airport, at Imam Khomeini Airport in Tehran, preparing to board my flight back to Australia, I did have an inkling that all was not right. And there were things that happened that in retrospect looked very suspicious, that I was being watched and monitored and surveilled. But that was just sort of the day prior to my arrest. Other than that, I had a great time.
And there was no sign at the conference that any trouble was afoot anywhere?
No sign at all.
They're very gracious hosts as always, correct?
Yeah, the Iranians are experts at hospitality and, you know, welcoming visitors and guests, and it's very much part of their culture.
Yeah, including the pizza and the chocolate cake, right? Later on?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that was Iranian hospitality. Maybe that they wanted to sort of manipulate me or instrumentalize that, but yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. I've heard stories when other hostages I've worked with, especially when it's the release part, they always will trip over themselves to try and make it seem as if, well, you know, we didn't do anything bad to you. It's just we're doing our job. And they try and shower you with gifts. I don't know if that happened to you. I don't remember reading that in the book, but we can talk about that in a second. Folks, for those of you who don't follow any of this, Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert, Kylie, spent about 2 years, almost more than 2 years, locked up in one of the most horrible prison systems in that part of the world. She was a hostage. She was accused of espionage, which she had many times said. In fact, I think when you came out, there was a quote I read somewhere where you were saying, I'm not a spy. You still talk about not being a spy. It doesn't take much, though, to trigger the Iranian government, especially sometimes academics. And they'll pick you up for political reasons, which was the reason why I think they picked her up. In fact, she may never know why they picked her up. Maybe they picked her up just to do exactly what they did. But she was a harrowing ordeal, and there's many layers to it. In the book, you kind of get into a lot of that. What was it about this process that, I guess, looking back, was most shocking to you? I mean, we know you were tortured. You were tortured physically. You were tortured psychologically. But then you did stuff you pretty ran these people ragged. And I think that's what kept you alive, and it's what kept you sane. I mean, you were doing stuff you could have escaped at one point. And you talk a little bit about that in the book. But looking back on all of this, if there was one thing that you can point out to say that's what kept me sane, what would that be?
What kept me sane was the solidarity and friendship of my fellow prisoners. You know, solitary confinement in particular is designed to break you psychologically. It's designed to, you know, make you confess to whatever they're pressuring you to confess to in the interrogations, and open yourself up and tell them everything you know as well. It's a form of psychological torture, and they're masterful at it in Iran. And my fellow prisoners reaching out to me at great risk to themselves, actually, and offering me in sort of the most unlikely of places this hand of friendship was what disrupted that solitary confinement and disrupted the whole point of it, which was to have me feel isolated and alone. So, you know, those friendships that I was able to covertly establish in the Dualif unit, you know, over the almost 2 years that I spent there with some of my fellow prisoners, you know, against the odds and in very strange and bizarre ways, were really what got me through. And I, you know, it's a credit to those brave Iranian women who reached out to me, because, you know, I can't tell you how much they impacted my experience there.
You talk a lot about that in your book, and you can tell, it's palpable that you have some bonds there that I think will be there for a lifetime, and some friendships and some curious things you also had to say about the IRGC, which we'll talk about in 1 second. You also said at one point, I'd rather go without food than human interaction. And I think you also said that during a 60-minute interview, which was great. What do you mean by that you'd rather go without food than human interaction? I mean, I literally know what you're saying, But there's a lot there that you talk about in your book that goes to that. What is it that someone feels when they're in a situation like this, when you're just picked up for being Australian, but you feel almost powerless, but then you find all this empowerment in fellow prisoners? Is that what you're getting at? The fact that you had that human interaction, that you kind of went out of your way to have it and make sure you protected it? That's the way it came across in your book. You would protect those contacts too when you were in there.
Yeah, I think us human beings have an inherent deep-seated need for human interaction. This is why solitary confinement is psychological torture, because we need it on a visceral level. We are not designed to be solitary animals. We're a group species. And when deprived of human interaction, we do go kind of crazy. It's something that you don't realize you need until it's taken away from you. Just like freedom is something that you don't value really or think about until it's taken away from you. And then you realize it's a crucial element to your existence as well. So, you know, my relationship with food was very fraught and complicated. I went on hunger strike multiple times and, you know, I became quite adept at depriving myself of food in order to try and achieve something. I didn't care about food when I was in there, but human interaction was everything to me, and it was what got me through and helped me survive. And I just think, you know, to me, I would be clamoring and clawing at every tiny little interaction, every sentence, every greeting, even from the prison guards when I was alone there, because it gave me something, recognition of my personhood, of my humanity, the fact that I was there and I existed. There's nothing worse that you can do to a prisoner than ignore them and leave them alone, you know, in a cell for days or weeks or months or even years on end and not acknowledge their humanity. So for me, it was just a crucial ingredient or element that I needed to stay sane and survive that place.
And I'm going to skip the details of what they did to you. I want people to read it. And folks, buy your book and read it. It's important for many. Even if you're not following the hostage issue, I think you need to read this book, especially to better understand what some American families are going through and other families are going through. But for folks listening to the show, especially when folks feel that their loved ones have been forgotten, to understand what happens in these places. These are not nice people, the people who were holding her. And that not being forgotten aspect of it, you know, that's something that Kylie talks about. It's also important to say the name. And a lot of times here in America, we don't have politicians and policymakers who are brave enough to say people's names, and they don't understand why. And this is the first book I've read on the Iran hostages, where I think you'll better understand why it's so important to talk about that. Not just the physical suffering, but the mental suffering, but there's a lot to it. In your book, at one point, when they took you to do some of the video interrogation, it's kind of a, I don't know if this is funny or not, but it read kind of funny to me. This fellow, Kazi Zadeh, which we'll talk about in a minute, you told him, "I am a prisoner. What do you expect? A fashion show?" I'm not laughing. I mean, it's not funny. I mean, I see the picture here. You're not amused at all. If your eyes speak, you're angry as hell. And I could see it just in that photo. Were you trying to be funny when you told him this, or were you yelling at him? What happened during that video session when you actually said to him, "What is this, a fashion show?"
I mean, I guess the context there is that I was, as many other prisoners also, this is a pretty standard thing. I was taken to a film studio to film a lot of the interrogation questions, my answers to them, for purposes of presumably of making propaganda clips and releasing them, which the Iranian regime did when I was released finally. They put together a 15-minute long propaganda clip. But interestingly, none of my responses in this film studio made it into the clip. And I think it's perhaps because I didn't really play ball, and my answers weren't considered of sufficient propagandistic value, maybe. I don't know. But You know,
no, just your eyes, I could tell. I wouldn't put that out there if I were them. This lady, you were not going to. You fought, at least on the video. I mean, I could tell, but you did inside the prison. You fought, but boy, you were not happy to be recording any of that, and it shows. I mean, you could see it coming from your eyes, that's great.
Thank you. I mean, I managed to derail that. They went on the day of my release, they put me outside Evan Prison with the gates of Evan Prison behind me as a backdrop and tried to interrogate me there with a camera. And I did not play ball. You know, they were asking me, oh, you know, how did they treat you inside and everything? And I was in Farsi, the whole thing was by then. And I just listed a litany of complaints and, you know, you tortured me, the food's shit, what do you want from me? You know, and so, yeah, none of that made it in either. But you know, the fashion show thing, I think Kazi Zadeh was constantly criticizing my appearance and the kinds of clothes that I would wear, which were cobbled together from other items of clothing that prisoners who had shared my cell might have left behind, bits of prison uniform and items they'd found in my suitcase that they'd given to me. And, you know, this guy would make all sorts of comments about my facial hair or the state of my, you know, my hijab or whatever it may be. And there's a very gendered aspect there, of course. I mean, my experience, and as I recount in the book, my being a woman in such a place, particularly when all the interrogators were men and all the people in power were men and all the, you know, heads of the prison unit I was kept in were men. There was a very much gendered element to my treatment, and sometimes I was able to use that to my advantage, but other times it just resulted in overt sexism and different treatment to my disadvantage. So, you know, dealing with all these constant comments about my appearance was just unfortunately, you know, the reality as a woman there.
I mean, I have a note here to ask you this because I'm just curious about it. How did they react when you cursed at them? Did you curse at them as much as you, like the F-bomb, did you dish it out that as much as I think you did?
Especially when you're very angry. look, it would be in English, but they would understand it. And they wouldn't like it, obviously. Men would probably do the same, but they, you know, they would... We're dealing with the Revolutionary Guards are highly religious, male.
Tell people a little bit give folks who may not know what we're talking about some context about what those people are like, generally speaking.
You know, they are men who are in their roles normally because of somebody they know, some family member or someone else who's a senior Revolutionary Guards person has got them that job. It's a very insular, sort of cult-like group in a way, particularly in the prison. I think they all live in gated compounds. They themselves are under constant monitoring. They come from highly religious, highly brainwashed sect in society. They're very sheltered, I think, in terms of the kind of information they're exposed to, even within Iran. And everything's kept within the family. So all of the female prison guards in the women's unit were related to some of the men, either by marriage, you know, it was somebody's wife or sister or even probably mother of somebody senior male who worked there as well. So, you know, yeah, you're dealing with very close-minded, highly religious individuals.
They almost sound like troglodytic type, or are these people, you say brainwashed, but... Do you really think they believe half the stuff they're out there spewing? Or do you really think they are totally programmed to act a certain way?
Some of them, yes. Some of them, no. Some of them were clearly more intelligent than that. And some of them were highly opportunistic, using their contacts and connections to maneuver their way into the position they were in, perhaps without signing up to all the, you know, the crazy conspiracy theories and other, you know, mumbo-jumbo religious stuff that they had to profess publicly in order to join the Revolutionary Guard Corps. But many of them also were dyed-in-the-wool adherents of this ideology. and firmly believed it. So, it, you know, it really depended who you encountered. Some of the women were very ideological. Others were just there because it was a job and they had a husband or a brother who got them that job. And it's very difficult as a religious woman in Iranian society to do any kind of work at all, because the idea is you're going to be a homemaker and you're going to have children and that's your job and your role in society. So if you perhaps wanted a salary and you didn't want to be a homemaker, then doing such work for the Revolutionary Guard was still considered acceptable because you're furthering the cause. And there was a clear need for female prison guards because of the gender segregation. You know, men couldn't be there looking after the female prisoners. So it was a sort of one of the only acceptable jobs that they could do. So, yeah, it, you know, I encountered all sorts there and I got to know some of my captors very, very well. And it was, you know, very interesting, some of the insights that I gleaned from them.
This guy, Kazi Zadeh, we're not going to talk too much about him because I don't want to destroy, somebody's going to buy the book. We don't want to, you know, we want to leave some suspense in there. But this guy sounds like one creepy dude. I mean, they're all creepy, but this guy is a special sort of creepy. If you were to summarize this guy down to one word, what would you say about him? This, he was like your head captor, right? He was in charge of trying to break you, and or was he more your handler?
Yeah, he wasn't an interrogator. He was kind of the boss of the interrogators, the head of the case. Uh-huh. Yeah, and also a recruiter for the Revolutionary Guard Intelligence Wing. In one word, I would say probably narcissist. okay. But, you know, this guy, this is the gendered aspect of it again, right? He developed a sort of an unhealthy interest in me and, you know, sexually harassed me, we could say, or put me through, you know, inappropriate, a series of inappropriate behaviors that continued for, I don't know, 8-9 months perhaps in the last half of my incarceration, which I couldn't escape from because he had full control over me and my situation, including over negotiating with the Australian government for my release. So it was a very difficult position.
I shouldn't call him your handler. He wanted to be your handler. He wanted, these guys are trying to get you to spy for them as a condition for, which I find kind of, you see, some of the stuff that, again, put the physical torture and the mental torture aside for a minute. Some of this, and I've heard this in other cases, it sounds crazy. Like they're asking somebody they just swooped up there from a conference, here, you're going to spy for us, you know. And some of the stuff they say, like, for example, in the book you go into, some of the stuff he was telling you, like this section here where he says, it's true that there's a Jewish lobby in America that controls the world through international finance and that no American can be elected without Israel's support, or some other crazy stuff. Like, I've heard the Jews killed Jesus, and in Europe, they drink his blood of Christians and some of their festivals. I mean, do they actually believe this stuff?
I mean, yeah, as far as the anti-Semitism stuff goes, I think most of them do believe it. I mean, that's what they've been taught from a very young age. It's sort of tinged with religious justification. And
but he also said that Hollywood staged the moon landing.
Yeah. You know, look, Iranian society in general seems to be pretty open to believing conspiracy theories. I think it's a feature of living under a repressive authoritarian regime where nothing that the government tells you is necessarily the truth. So you have to question everything. And a lot of these conspiracy theories are kind of, I don't know whether they firmly believe them, but they're certainly open to them being true. Even during COVID, because the pandemic started when I was in prison in Iran still throughout 2020, they believed, they had all these wild and wacky ideas about COVID. You know, they claimed the US invented it and it was biological warfare against China. So inverting and twisting, you know, the narrative on COVID. But at the same time, they believed it didn't exist at all and refused to wear masks or take any measures whatsoever to protect themselves because they thought the whole thing was fake. So there's no internal logic necessarily to the conspiracy theories, but groups like the Revolutionary Guard seem to be particularly open to believing them for some reason.
We've been talking to Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert. a political scientist, specialized in the Middle East, a former hostage held by Iran, and an Australian. Well, you're a UK. You're not Australian technically. Are you Australian? Can I call you Australian because you live in Australia?
Sorry. Yeah, I'm an Australian British dual national, but I was born in Australia and I live
in
Australia.
That's right. And we're halfway through this, and there's a few items I still want to talk about your incarceration. I think folks need to buy her book. But before we break off into some of the more timely, current things in hostage diplomacy that I want to chat with you about, you mentioned in your book at some point that you met Qazi Zadeh's wife. Tell us briefly what that was like, and how did that happen?
I managed to discern that he had maneuvered his wife into the Dualif unit where I was living as a prison guard in order to monitor and feedback information on me directly to him, bypassing the official sources. Because there's all sorts of rivalries and rifts and factions within the Revolutionary Guard. And the person who was head of the Dualif unit at the time was quite friendly with me and with some of the other female prisoners, and would often protect us from the worst excesses of the interrogators, including Qazi Zadeh, and was also cottoning on to Qazi Zadeh's unhealthy interest in me and trying to thwart some of his, bad behavior. So he had basically pushed his wife into a role of prison guard in order to monitor me and get information that perhaps wasn't being passed on via official sources, because this guy at the top, you know, was acting to protect me a little bit. And then the wife found out or could sense that he was interested in me as well, and, you know, became quite vindictive and jealous. And it was really difficult for me because I couldn't let on that I knew she was his wife, because, you know, that the consequences of that would have been horrendous for me. But at the same time, I was being mistreated by this prison guard through no fault of my own. She was essentially blaming me and punishing me for her husband's interest in me, which was not something I could control.
It's surreal. That is surreal. July 2020, so we're skipping over a lot, folks, because we don't have a lot of time. Before you were released later in November, you were transferred to Karshak prison. You were in Evin for a while, long while. Then you were transferred to Karshak. Compare Evin and Karshak. You read a lot of the human rights reports. Evin's the most horrible, some say, but then there's Karshak and some other of these specialized prisons. Which was worse, if any? I mean, if any, can be compared to worse? Are they the same, or are they a different type of bad?
Look, Karshak is considered to be worse by Iranian prisoners. And it is a place that political prisoners are threatened with being sent to if they misbehave, particularly, you know, from the public wards of Evin. And they do send them there. I mean, there were several prominent political prisoners with me in Karshak who had been in Evin and, like me, were, you know, exiled to this prison in the desert south of Tehran as a punishment, including Nasrin Sotoudeh, who's a very prominent human rights lawyer in Iran, and Suheila Hijab, who's another lawyer and a Kurdish rights and women's rights activist. So there were several of them there, Golrukh Irai, another one. And they, you know, a lot of these people then go back to Evin a year later or so once the punishment is meted out, but they are considered to be worse. For me, it was actually better, though, to be in Karshak, because I never made it to the public ward of Evin prison where all of these political prisoners are being kept. I was just in the highly restrictive, essentially interrogation unit of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, this Dualif unit, 2A in Evin. And that was just horrific. I mean, I was in solitary confinement for 12 months cumulatively in that time. And it's a very sort of deprived place. Karshak is the opposite, in that I went from being in solitary for 7 months in one stretch in 2020 to being sat in a vehicle blindfolded and transported to Karshak and suddenly living in a room with 100 other women, which was sort of psychological shock of that was extreme, because, you know, I wasn't used to having so many people around me, and I was just thrust into this position suddenly of living with 100 other women, most of whom were convicted of criminal offences, who, you know, they weren't political prisoners. I think there was about 3 or 4 other political prisoners who were largely protesters picked up in the 2019 protests in that room with me, and the rest were all convicted of everything from murder to armed robbery to fraud, you know, financial crimes of a variety of different natures, or people who would literally just seem to be completely innocent and were picked up and thrown in there because of a family dispute or maybe bad hijab or something. And because most were very impoverished, they didn't have lawyers, they didn't have advocates, and they kind of got stuck in limbo and therefore had to spend, you know, a couple of years in a car check before eventually being let out, but for no real clear reason. So it was a real mixed bag of people, and the conditions there were pretty horrific. I mean, the sanitary situation in the bathrooms and the outdoor area that we had access to was just sort of a barren wasteland. It was sort of a hellish landscape of a place, with no, you know, real medical care or attention either. But I actually thrived there and much preferred being there to being in Evin in solitary confinement. And it's because, yeah, I was able to make friends and have some sort of routine there, and I was under far less strict surveillance as well, and was able to live a freer existence there amidst, you know, all of those women, than I was in solitary confinement back in Evin.
You did something very brave. Well, you did a lot of brave stuff, but you did something especially brave that ties into, I guess, how you got out in November, I think 25th or so of 2020. You initiated a contact with the Australian government. You got a letter leaked out, got to your prime minister, I think. And your family was going through their own stress during that time as well. There's a lot of folks that we work with at the Global Liberty Alliance and through just fellow advocates in this space who struggle, the families especially struggle with going public or not going public. What drove you, first of all, to get that letter out? You talk about that in the book, if you could tell that briefly though, but how did it all connect, I guess, on the outside eventually? Because my sense is from reading your book and listening to some of your interviews is that the Australian government had to be prodded, much like, unfortunately, the U.S. government has to be prodded sometimes to do what do the right thing and spring one of their nationals from this place. I mean, do you think if the Australians had done their job that you would have had to have leaked the letter to your prime minister? That's very risky. If they had caught you doing that, who knows what would have happened?
Yeah, I wanted my situation to be public. After about 6 months or so of my incarceration, I came to the decision that whatever the Australian government's doing, they're not doing it fast enough, or I can't see any evidence of anything changing as a result of it. I think it needs to be public. And the sort of internal communications that I was having with other prisoners led me to see that that was advantageous as well. And I begged my family on the phone to speak to the media, but they wouldn't, because the foreign ministry here had sort of put pressure on them not to and to stay quiet. And, you know, they're law-abiding citizens. They have no experience of geopolitics or hostage situations. And so they just believed whatever the government told them. And I became very frustrated. And about 12 months into my incarceration, after I'd been convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison in Iran for espionage, I, you know, through a very convoluted and complex series of events, was able to leak several letters out of the prison. Some of them were copies in Farsi of letters that I'd written to judicial officials and others in Iran protesting the human rights abuses of my case and maintaining my innocence. But there was this one letter in English to Scott Morrison, who was the then Prime Minister of Australia, basically begging him to do more to prioritise my case and secure my release. And that letter was published, I think, in the UK initially. So Australian media knew I was in prison, but didn't publish my situation at the request of the government too. So there was some sort of, I guess, not alliance, but understanding between the domestic media in Australia and the government that they shouldn't publish my situation. And that frustrated me too, because, you know, obviously there's a duty of care there, and the media has to weigh up whether or not they're going to do harm to somebody by publicizing their arrest and detention in a foreign country. But at the same time, I think they also should be skeptical of the government when the government says that it's in my interest as a detainee not to have this publicly be known about. If they don't furnish evidence of that, then they should be skeptical as to why it's in my interests and not the government's interests, say, to not have media breathing down their neck and constantly asking, what are you doing, what are you not doing to free this person? So it was actually a different country's media, the UK, that published this letter initially. And then after the cat was out of the bag, well, then the Australian media jumped in and published it as well and started to write articles about my predicament. So I had made that conscious decision that I needed it to be public, and I wanted to fight against my government's efforts to keep a lid on it. And I think it was the right decision, because I saw on the ground, you know, in my cell in Evin, that greater attention was paid to my medical situation by the authorities, and that there was a greater sensitivity around my treatment following that publication.
You know that there's one, I don't know, I think it was a consular official that you finally were able to meet with, where you pretty much, I think, threw the table or grabbed his feet or something, and his assistant's feet. I forget exactly how it happened, but the fact that you were that forceful and leaned into it, I think, helped, because a lot of times it's, I don't know how it is in Australia and their foreign service, but over here we have a lot of good people in this, doing this line of work, unlike the Americans, which we don't have an embassy there. You all had a consular presence there. You have, I think you've been there since the late 1960s, I think. So there's a lot more flexibility for Australia to get their nationals out. And it's quite shocking that it took them as long to kind of engage, I think, as robustly as they could have. Why do you think they didn't? I mean, we know in these cases, governments have competing equities. But in the case of Australia, and the fact that your case was becoming so high profile, eventually became high profile, which I think is how you got out, helped you get out sooner. What do you think at the beginning of this, now looking back, is it that they didn't know how to handle this, where they weren't unsure, was it just Iran? Or do you think something on the Australian side needs to improve to make sure this sort of stuff doesn't happen again?
Oh gosh, so much needs to improve on the Australian side. In terms of my own case, I'd love to know at what point it was escalated to the political level. Because at the very beginning, certainly it was just a consular issue. It was being managed by the consular wing of our Foreign Affairs Department. And as is every other time, you know, an Australian is arrested abroad for whatever reason, at what point was it escalated and elevated to the level of the political decision makers? I suspect it took several months for that to happen. I think another reason why we were so slow to react was because we weren't talking to the right people. And that's because of diplomatic norms in consular relations between states. You know, Australia would have reached out to the Iranian foreign ministry. I know that our foreign minister at the time had conversations with Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister. And, you know, they were talking to their counterparts, but these were not the people who had arrested me. The people who had arrested me were the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who were actually competitors of the Iranian government, and did not like the Iranian foreign ministry, did not keep them in the loop about who they'd arrested and why, and wouldn't even confirm to them that they had me for a few months there at the beginning. So, you know, they weren't talking to the right people. And it was only when the Australians ultimately appointed an intelligence guy to and gave him, empowered him with the ability to reach out directly to the Revolutionary Guard and bypass the Iranian Foreign Ministry and their regular diplomatic contacts, that they were actually able to affect anything and confirm what was happening to me and start to negotiate over my release. So that all took a lot of time to get to that point. And actually, I think there were a lot of missed opportunities, particularly at the very beginning, because I was on a temporary arrest warrant. It wasn't clear that they were actually going to charge me with a crime and put me on trial. And in those early few months, robust diplomatic engagement could have seen some sort of deal for my release, hushed up, and, you know, a quick departure. Once my case entered the judicial system in Iran, it had to be seen through to the end. And, you know, that's when I effectively became a hostage. So, yeah, I think there were a lot of missed opportunities. But in the end, I can't fault them. They did get me out, which I'm eternally grateful to them for.
Yeah, I asked because I think we need to improve. I think there's the coordination that, especially with the US, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. You know, the US right now is working with Canada and trying to expand how we handle some of these cases, maybe through a NATO-like model, and coordinate information and resources. I'm a little skeptical about the approach, but it is a better option than sitting by and trying nothing. But the fact that I'm skeptical because we've been dealing with this problem with Iran since the 1980s. You know, this is not new. We should know who the players are. There's plenty of contact, especially with the Americans and this whole JCPOA business. We know they take people hostage. We know it's a business. We know it's a big criminal cartel. But you're right, the fact that they could have stopped it from ever reaching Salavati, I think could have, I mean, it takes minutes, I mean, days, to, I think you could solve these cases sometimes if you move swiftly. But in some cases, we don't. And I've seen that over here where recently, you know this, the U.S. government announced the release of several people that were very happy they are out. And then in the same breath, they said, oh, there's nobody else there. That's not true. There's several people that were left behind, including Jimmy Sharmad from California, who's been sentenced to death. There's Shahab Dalili from Virginia, who's been there. And he was sharing a cell with Nizar Zaka and Shiwei Wang. So he's been there a long time. And I know about at least one other American who's in even prison, who has chosen to remain quiet, doesn't want his name out there. And we're going to respect that. But what is it about some of this, though? Despite all this power that, you know, the Five Eyes have and all this information that we should know about Iran, cases like yours happen. Why? I know you don't know yet, but do you think if they had moved faster and they had dealt a firm hand to Iran, that the IRGC would understand, yeah, we're not going to mess around with this person. Just let it go.
That's really difficult to answer. The IRGC would have wanted something in exchange for me, even at the very beginning. They wouldn't have just let me go for no reason. But something could have been offered. Perhaps a carrot and a stick approach could have been taken. Somebody could have been offered, you know, somebody in an Australian prison or whatever, very quickly, recognizing that this is a repeat issue, that these people are perpetrators who've been doing this again and again, and it's a sort of a business model with nationals of a variety of Western countries, and that ultimately they want something in exchange. So why draw it out over a number of years? Why not just offer something straight up, get that person out? You know, such quick, expeditious action on behalf of the Australian government could have potentially seen my release. But I don't know. We know it's all hypothetical at the end of the day. But yeah, these are repeat perpetrators. And I think we need to target them as such. I mean, we a lot of these Five Eyes nations that you mentioned have Magnitsky sanctions now. I don't understand why we cannot sanction individual perpetrators in Iran and in other countries that undertake hostage taking. Because to me, it seems like ripe, you know, fodder for Magnitsky sanctions. We know the identities of several people in Iran that are repeat perpetrators of this practice. Why can't we just sanction them? So I think, you know, a carrot and stick approach can be followed. Certainly when it comes to the US, this cannot be divorced from its broader Iran policy. And the Iran policy of the Biden administration, in my view, has been a total mess and a total disaster. And therefore, their ability to respond to hostage-taking situations, you know, by Iran of American citizens is lessened by the fact that they're making so many concessions to Iran in so many other spheres. And they're perceived of as being weak and easy to manipulate and easy to gain concessions from by the Iranians. So I think this is one reason why clearly they weren't able to negotiate a deal to end all deals and get all the American nationals out in the recent deal that happened a few months ago, because they're seen as being weak and bad negotiators in the context of broader Biden administration's policy toward Iran and the JCPOA.
How important it is to, in your opinion, when dealing with the Iranians, is it important to show resolve and strength versus this other policy? Here in the United States, we're kind of in two camps. You either engage with them and diplomacy will bring them around, they'll never have a nuclear bomb. I'm not in that school. I think Iran is there or just about there with a nuclear bomb, and it's just a matter of time before they get it, unless something else dramatically happens to stop them. Or the other camp that says, no, we have to follow the hard line and negotiate, like you said, with carrot and stick, with a lot more stick than carrot. If not, they won't respect us. Do you think hostage diplomacy falls in that space, or do you think it should be treated parallel to everything else?
I don't think it's parallel. I think it's all linked together at the end of the day. Whether or not the Iranians respect you has a huge impact on your ability to negotiate something with them to sort of, you know, to free hostages or whatever else it may be. Constantly oscillating and offering up concessions for no real gain or benefit telegraphs to the Iranians' weakness, and that weakness, even if it's, you know, related to the nuclear deal, also flows into the issue of hostage recovery too. So I think a firm line needs to be drawn under some of these concessions and some of these deals that have been done with the Iranians, and a tougher stance needs to be adopted, because we haven't seen them change their behavior, whether that be their meddling in other countries' affairs in the region, their sponsorship of terrorism, their ballistic missile program, their nuclear program, or their hostage taking. We haven't seen them change their behavior in response to concessions. The only time we saw them change their behavior was with the impact of sanctions over a number of years enforced globally, not just by the United States, in the lead up to the JCPOA deal that Obama signed. And that also came with the threat of military action, of course. So that they, you know, that is a different era now, though. We need to recognize that the Iranians aren't behaving in the same way now as they were back then. But I think taking the threat of military force off the table and other tougher measures, including enforcing sanctions on their oil industry, you know, this has a big impact on their behavior. And we're just telegraphing weakness right now.
Would you agree that all instrument of state power should be on the table, from diplomacy to whatever else is needed to bring Americans home or any hostage home?
Yes, I think so. And the US is in a unique position in that it's able to pull many levers that middle power countries like Australia or some of the European countries just simply aren't able to pull. You know, what does Australia have with Iran other than diplomacy? I mean, we're not going to threaten military action. Australia's not going to threaten military action over, you know, hostages. We don't really have huge economic ties that we can leverage in terms of sanctions. We only have diplomacy. But the US, you guys have so many more options in dealing with Iran than we do. So why not use them?
Let me ask you, how important is, now that you're out and you're still getting your life back together again, before we ask you what's next for you, which you probably don't have an answer to that yet, but how important is, and you alluded to this earlier, accountability efforts? So in the life cycle of one of these cases, we always tell the folks we work with, there's of course bringing them home, but then there's the next phase, you know, your reintegration into life, which unfortunately, I can't help with that, but there's a lot of great groups that can do that. But then there's also the accountability phase. and it's a highly personal one. I have an opinion, a strong one, that the U.S. government, no matter what, should hold hostage takers to account using all instruments of state power, whatever those instruments happen to be. But justice, of course, can mean something to one person, to another person. But I think we have to start with that baseline. And we have it in the law now, under the Levinson law, the Hostage Taking Accountability Act law, that there will be accountability done. What that looks like, it can vary from case to case. For you as a former hostage, how important is accountability for the people who did this to you? Would you like to see some of these people maybe someday arrested or put on a watch list so they can never travel outside Iran, Interpol red notices so that they won't even think about jumping, getting on an airplane and going anywhere in the world and being arrested? Do you think that helps deter, or forget about deterrence, would it be nice to have what you would view justice in your case? Because you say in your book at the very end, or somewhere near the end, and you're very magnanimous and you're very generous, and I could tell you have a good heart, because you, despite what you went through, you say in the book that the Revolutionary Guards taught me that sometimes good people do bad things and you choose to forgive them. Some families wouldn't do that. Some hostages wouldn't do that. But do you think forgiveness is the same thing as holding them to account? Do you want to see any of the people who did this to you face a court of law, perhaps?
Absolutely. I think justice is imperative to, I think, the hostage's ability to move on with their life and also process and make sense of what happened to them. The idea that there has been no justice, and, you know, in Australia, we don't have a Levinson Act. We don't have the ability to use our domestic courts here to seek redress. We don't, you know, I campaigned here in Australia for the Australian government to apply sanctions to Iranian hostage takers, but that fell on deaf ears. There's been no repercussion, no implication for my hostage taking or that of a number of other Australians. There's about three or four others in my situation who had also been arrested in Iran. The fact that there has been no justice and there's been, you know, just a continuance of the status quo in diplomatic relations is angering to me. I mean, I just think, and I'm going to continue this conversation. I'm going to continue this campaign here in Australia. I think we do need a Levinson Act or something similar. I think we do need to restructure our consular affairs in terms of how consular manages such cases here in Australia too. And yeah, I mean, the fact that we know who some of these individuals are and they're repeat perpetrators, yet there have been no repercussions for them is shameful. And I do not understand the reticence of my government or indeed of other governments to sanction, to name and shame, and to do something about this practice, because it's happening again and again. And they come away looking weak. You know, the fact that there is no repercussion for Iran, given its arrest of innocent Australian citizens, not just myself, but others too, makes us look weak in our relations with that country. Why can't we stand up for our citizens and say, you're going to do this? Fine. We're going to slap you with these economic sanctions. We're going to target those individuals we know to be repeat perpetrators with Magnitsky sanctions. We're going to put an Interpol red notice out for them, whatever. It's not like it's going to cost much political capital here in Australia. Australia really doesn't care about its relationship with Iran to that great extent. Sure, it'll ruffle a few feathers in terms of our, you know, meetings with the Iranian ambassador or whatever happens. But ultimately, the Iranians know that they're doing this. Perhaps they would expect there to be some reaction. Maybe they're surprised that there hasn't been. And it's an incentive for them to keep doing it. As long as there is no effort to punish and disincentivize Iran from doing hostage diplomacy, they're going to keep doing it. So to me, it's a no-brainer. And in terms of, on a personal level, I would like to see justice, some sort of justice, some sort of repercussion for what I went through. And so far, I don't see that happening.
You're not the only one. I think there's a lot of American former hostages who went to the Iran system that feel exactly the way you do. And in fact, even here in America, where we have, depending on your point of view, the privilege of hosting the UN. To me, it's the curse of hosting the UN, allowing people like the Iranian foreign minister here and this person they call the president, who has the blood of thousands of people potentially on his hands, who were part of that hostage-taking machine, given visas to come to this country. A lot of us would like to see those people not allowed into this country. I think reciprocity is earned. You don't freely give it. And when you treat our people the way you treat our people, you don't deserve to come here. And I go one step further, and maybe I'll have to go to confession for this, but I don't even think we should be giving healthcare humanitarian visas to regime officials to come to our country for life-saving medical treatments. If you're going to treat our people like subhuman people, you know, America's a generous place, but stop taking us for granted. And I think that's the problem we're having. There's this disconnect in America also, where we go through these processes of one administration does one thing, the other one does something else. We need something uniform across the board. And giving into concessions all the time is not good for the long term. It's endangering Americans and endangering Europeans. And then we don't hold these people to account. And that's a really sad thing. But at the same time, the diaspora here has also been, Iranian diaspora has been very active. I don't know if you can do that in your neck of the woods, but they're going after these people at universities. They're going after folks. In fact, over at Princeton, there's a few people where Wang, Xiwei Wang, you know the whole story about Wang and Princeton University. The spotlight's been put on them also. So accountability can take many, many forms, but I think it starts with the governments first. They have to set the right tone. As we wrap this up, what's your advice for families that are going through this? And do you think people should be speaking up? What would you like to see from America as it's going through this phase right now, where we have at least three or four more people left there? I mean, what advice would you give these families? In fact, any family who has somebody locked up in that place?
It's really hard to give advice because every case is different, but I would say that I don't see any evidence or precedent for staying quiet. I don't see any evidence suggesting that staying silent and not being public and loud about your loved one's predicament is going to impact them in any way, in any negative way. I don't see, you know, perhaps in other situations, yes, that can happen, particularly when it's a non-state actor, terror group or criminal gang or whoever it may be that takes somebody hostage and wants a ransom payment. Potentially that could raise the person's price and complicate negotiations. But going public and being loud in your support of your loved one and demands for your government to do more, at least in the case of Iran and state hostage taking, I don't see any repercussion for that loved one in prison should you do so, which is, you know, generally what the Foreign Service or the government will tell the family. If you speak out, then your loved one might be harmed in prison or situation might be more complicated for them. So I would urge that and to demand more, you know, to demand more of our governments, to demand that they act more swiftly and to demand that they collaborate with one another over some of these cases, particularly given that this is an international phenomenon. It's not just affecting Americans, it's not just affecting Brits or Australians, it's affecting citizens of all Western countries. Why can't they collaborate and work together? And I know there are efforts afoot right now to do so, but I'm also skeptical in practice as to how much, you know, some of these governments will actually collaborate. You know, we need to learn from each other, we need to bandy together and support one another in various countries in dealing with, you know, the behavior of states like Iran that take hostages. So demand more of your elected representatives and be loud and campaign. That would be my recommendation.
That's great. And now, because of folks like Kylie and all the former hostages, they've, you know, when this 10 years ago, there were a lot of groups that didn't exist, that exist today, that are out there advocating, supporting each other. They're talking to each other and building networks of people. And if you want to connect with any of them, I'm sure Kylie will be happy to help you connect with those people. You can reach out to us, send us emails. There's a few groups out there, the Foley Foundation, there's Hostage Aid Worldwide that Kylie advises and helps out. There's Amr Fakhouri Foundation. There's sort of a few groups out there. And what's great is that these are all families of former hostages or former hostages who've fought hard to give that voice that folks don't have. And you'd be surprised how many commonalities there are in not just the Iran cases, but cases that happen in other countries like Cuba, Venezuela, Syria. There are a lot of common threads. And speaking up, I agree with Kylie, it has to happen. As we wrap this up, thank you, first of all, for spending your morning, part of your morning with us. We're grateful that you could spend some time with you. I know you're very busy, but what's next for you? What's happening beyond? Are you going to go start teaching? Are you going to stay doing advocacy work? Or are you still trying to sort all that out?
I've spent the past 3 years trying to sort all that out, but now finally I am returning to academia. I've got a 3-year research position at a university here, actually researching this subject, wrongful and arbitrary detention policy. And I've also set up an advocacy group here in Australia called AWADA, Australian Wrongful and Arbitrary Detention Alliance, with two other people who were held wrongfully abroad, Sean Turnell, who was in Myanmar, and Chung Lai, who was in China, all Australian citizens. We've set up this alliance to try and push for policy reform and legislative change here in Australia on the subject of arbitrary detention. So I'm doing more work in this space, and I hope that we will see reforms here in Australia similar to that which the US has, you know, already passed through a decade or so before us. But yeah, I'm also trying to get on with my life. I've had a baby, I've had a child, right. And I'm sort of trying to get back to a sort of normal state of existence at the same time as well.
Well, they robbed you.
Not to be defined by it.
Yeah, they robbed you of one of your most precious commodities, which is, you know, health is number one and your family then, but your time. But something tells me that you're going to turbo speed past all that. It'll be a hiccup what happened to you, although it will take time, but you're leaning in, and we're grateful for your contributions, and we hope to hear more from AWADA, and to the extent we can help. It'd be nice to have an international conference of all these groups and bring you all together and talk about this, because there's a lot to do still, and we're grateful to have folks like you engage in this battle. So Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Jason, for all that you do and for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.